Brick Dunning. And the title of this session is The Complex Connections in Creation. Just by way of personal background, I am a geographer primarily, although I also do and teach geology. My research interests have been primarily in the area of environmental change, the causes and implications of environmental change, particularly focusing my research on rivers and the way that rivers are affected by environmental changes, both natural environmental changes and human-induced environmental changes. So I have a particular concern for water resources and their role in the world, and what the implications of environmental change are for water resources. I kind of feel like I should say just briefly a little bit about geography, because I think that shapes who I am and the way that I approach the subject. Geography is the study of the Earth's surface, and it includes both the natural features of the Earth's surface and the human-made features of the Earth's surface. And there are two traditional subdivisions within geography: physical geography, concentrating on the natural environment, and human geography, concentrating on the human activities, the distribution of population, economic resources, etc. But the discipline of geography as a whole, I think, throughout its history, has been about putting those two parts of itself together, how people interact with the environment, the ways that people affect the environment, and the ways that the environment in turn affects human activity. In that sense, geography has a long tradition as one of the environmental sciences, and one of the sources of thinking about our future of the environment. Now, for a short time this morning, I'd like to talk about the connectedness of all aspects of creation, to describe what I think that means, and to think with you for a moment about the implications of that. So I'm not really addressing a specific environmental problem as such, but more talking about the way that we think about the environment and the kind of rhetoric we use when we discuss environmental problems. And I think that when we talk about creation, it's important to recognize that all parts of the environment are interrelated, connected, and continuously interacting. Now, it seems too simple to bother saying in this context. We assume, certainly within this room, that everyone knows that. And I know that I could never express that as that interconnectedness as well as Jane has done on several occasions this week. I really appreciate her ability to evoke that sense of interconnectedness within the environment. But I think that outside the context of this seminar and outside the context of people who are genuinely concerned about the environment, there is not that sense of interconnectedness between all parts of the creation. And I believe when we talk about the environment to other people, even when we talk about the environment to within this group, we need to be absolutely explicit about the way that we make those connections among the different parts of creation. Now, we've done fairly well about connecting some parts with other parts. I think in the environmental sciences, we have begun to understand that all of the Earth's environmental system, really that the Earth is a dynamic living environmental system in which all aspects of what we would call the natural environment are continuously interacting with each other. The climate, the hydrology, the vegetation, the soils, the ecology, the landforms that make up the landscape are all in continuous interaction with each other. So that when one component of the environment changes, then all the other components of the environment are affected. And we know that to be true, and we appreciate the long history of that interaction leading to our present day environment. We're also increasingly aware that all human activity is connected in a vast world economy, and that when changes occur in one part of the world, they have economic repercussions for all other parts of the world. Finally, we're starting to make the connections between those two vast systems of both natural processes and human activities. They are absolutely and complexly intertwined with each other, so that any environmental change will affect the world economy. And any economic action has repercussions for the environment, which will in turn affect the world economy, which will in turn affect the environment, etc., etc. So that there is nothing that people do on the earth that does not affect the environment, and there's nothing about the environment that does not have some implication for human activity. Again, it sounds really too simplistic to say in this context, but we don't always say it when we talk about the environment. We don't always talk about the whole picture. One of the problems I have with some traditional environmental literature is the strong tendency to separate humans and nature, either explicitly or implicitly, and perhaps with that the further implication that people are evil and corrupt and nature is good and pure, and that our problems come from the evil people corrupting the pure environment. I think that's an easy sort of construct to slip into, but I think it's one that is ultimately false and perhaps even dangerous to make. People are part of the creation. Humans are fundamentally a part of the natural environment, just like rocks and trees and birds, neither superior nor inferior to the other parts in creation. There are objects that exist in creation and that processes that operate without direct human causation. So clearly people do not control the environment, but people do change the environment. In fact, every organism affects its environment as it uses resources to live. Because of the number of people and because of the kinds and extensiveness of human activities, the environmental changes brought on by human action now threaten to culminate in a potentially catastrophic manner. But people are not the only source of environmental change in the world. Volcanoes continue to erupt. The crustal plates that make up the Earth's surface continue to move. The Earth continues to wobble on its axis as it moves around the sun, changing the way that the atmosphere is heated and the way that the atmospheric motions take place in our weather systems. The changes brought on by people have been more extensive and more rapid than any other environmental changes, except perhaps for some asteroid impacts, and we're just beginning to appreciate what some of those events were like. As Jerry points out in his letter to the bishops, the recent environmental changes now threaten to undermine our life support systems on the planet, and the current rates of population growth and economic growth cannot be sustained. But these changes are things that happen within the creation as we attempt to live in this environment. These are not changes imposed on the creation by people trespassing where they don't belong. We are changing our environment from within, not imposing these changes externally. When I was reflecting on the Bible study from yesterday morning, we talked a little bit about creation. And when we say that God created the earth, I think there's a general tendency to think of creation as an event that happened. I think the study of earth history suggests rather that creation is a process. Jane yesterday talked about the unfolding of the earth, of the cosmos. People are placed on the earth as part of that creation. But being created in the image of God, we are also creator. So that people are both creator and creation. And I think that's a tricky role that we have not understood yet, nor have we handled very well. In essence, then, we live in a world that we helped create. And I think that if we go to the Gaia notion of a living planet, that this sort of hypothesis supports that same idea, because it talks about a world that is shaped by the organisms that live in it. The ozone layer, the atmospheric chemistry, the ecological relationships have all grown out of the organisms that have been part of the Earth throughout its history. So that all organisms help to create the world that they live in. People do it with more deliberation, and in recent centuries, much more effectiveness. I believe that God has given us tremendous creative power and complete freedom to use it. And if you look at what we have done to the world, you get a sense of how much power we have to change the world. The problems come in the fact that we have misused and abused our creative power. Human activities have been more often destructive than constructive relative to the rest of the creation. And we have set in motion some cycles of environmental change, which if we leave them unchanged, will have disastrous consequences. It may be because we did not understand this creative power we possess. We did not understand the role we have in that creation process. Maybe it's because we're selfish and we use that creative power for our own good. But we have gone about our role in creation in the wrong way, and that may be to our peril. Our mistake has been in not knowing how our actions affect the rest of the creation. We have built a way of life by using resources in such a way that we have ignored the fact that we're undermining our ability to survive. Here we come to what seems to be at least the unofficial model of this seminar. We must pay attention to the earth. We must listen to the earth. We must learn how the rest of creation works. Human life can only exist within a relatively narrow range of environmental conditions, and we threaten to change those conditions unless we conform our actions to the environmental systems and ecological relationships that control our living conditions. We must maintain the integrity of the biosphere as it exists now or not survive as a people. We have already compromised that ecological integrity and will probably continue to do so for the near future. There are many visions of what our relationship to the rest of creation should be. Some of those come from creation spirituality, some from what we might call a kind of modern natural theology, some from contemporary Christian theology. And I embrace those visions and support them, but we must now go on to ask how those visions can be accomplished. Such a sustainable creation is possible only by substantial changes in the way that people live. To accomplish those changes, the people of the world face some difficult decisions. as Al spoke of last night, fundamental changes in head and heart. And we need to begin to ask the questions of how such changes will be imposed, on whom and by whom. And in that sense, I find myself supporting the title of the World Council of Churches report that we talked about last night. Peace and justice are not possible without the integrity of creation, and the integrity of creation is not possible without peace and justice. There is no environmental problem that is not also a social and economic problem, and vice versa. At least when we begin to look at solutions, there is no solution to environmental problems that does not involve social and economic change on a very large order. So that I again come back to my initial point about the essential interconnectedness of all creation. If we believe in the wholeness of creation, then I think we must seek whole solutions to the brokenness that now typifies the world. And that we must begin to talk now not just about what the problems are, but about which practical and solutions that we can seek in the near future. And I'll close the presentation part of this and hope that we can begin to wrestle with these problems together in terms of discussion.
Well, since it's so late in the ecological hour, what recommendations do you have as expert coming in from your discipline? Certainly now we should have, coming from all the disciplines, I would think, some rather clear pointed recommendations. Whether mankind wants to live with them or not is another thing. He wants to act on them, wants to do anything about them is another thing. But I would think that some recommendations could be seen, and that people in your position would say, from my discipline, I think this and this needs to be done, and soon, and give us the context in which it needs to be done. How soon?
I can list the things that must be changed to slow and stop the cycles of environmental change that we have initiated, and I think Jerry has listed those in his report to the bishops fairly clearly. What worries me is the kinds of economic and social changes in the systems by which we currently live that must come about, and how do we it's not a matter of knowing what to do anymore, but it's a matter of at least we've begun to know what to do. It's a matter of how can we accomplish that in the world? How can we bring about those changes in the systems that now exist? And those are the harder questions that I don't have answers for at this point.
And I'd like to offer a little different interpretation of my letter to the bishop.
Okay.
I don't feel that I have in there, in life, an adequate description of what needs to be done. In fact, I don't feel like I know what needs to be done. I feel as though I'm just barely beginning to get some perception of the magnitude of the problem that we're up against. And I'm reminded of a definition of a fanatic that Jay Forrester, I think, was the first one to mention it to me. And that is someone who redoubles their effort after they've forgotten what the goal is. I think in a lot of ways we're acting like fanatics. We want to rush to redouble our effort at developing a new technology or implementing it or being hungry or whatever. And I think we've all kind of lost track of what the goal is. And I'm not sure that I've got straight in my mind what the goal is either. So I think that while of course we're going to be doing some things next Monday, so to speak, on Monday morning, I guess I just want to make a plea for each and every one of us saying to ourselves and really believing it that I don't know really what the magnitude of the problem is. And there's an awful lot of learning that I have to do yet. And not slipping into the mode of saying, well, if I cast my vote for somebody who thinks nuclear power is the answer, I've done my thing. There's a for solar energy or whatever, but there's a lot of kind of internalizing and searching yet as to what's wrong. Because I don't feel I have a full understanding of it, and I think that in the public as a whole, there are a precious few people who have anything approaching the level of understanding that I think we're going to need to work our way through all this.
I think part of it is that, you know, Rick, you said a couple of times, this is so simple, in a sense. And I think what you said is just wonderful. But I don't think that's part of what most people see. I really heard you giving a very visionary understanding of human existence. And I think that in and of itself says a lot.
Good. To kind of to respond to what Jerry said, you're absolutely right. But, I mean, if we look at the environmental response of the recent and current administrations, it has continued to be, we don't know what the problem is, so we need to study it some more before we take action. There is a sense in which, absolutely, you're right, but that we cannot wait for total understanding before we begin to move.
This is the thing that really is frightening to me and kind of debilitating is the timetable. If you're right in saying that the next decade is the crossroads here, and you're looking at the year 2030 as kind of, I mean, with your two grim, your possibilities, one very grim and one a lot better, but because the interconnectedness is both the kind of beauty and wonder and also the scary part, who and how, who's going to make these decisions and how are they going to be made and who's going to have enough broad information to be able to look at the whole world and make an environmental impact statement. And it has to be, as you were saying in the Bible study, it sort of has to be through the hierarchy in a sense. I mean, that's not probably where we want to end up, but if any action is going to be taken fast enough, it has to happen through the governments and the leaders of society more than the grassroots for it to happen fast enough.
I would also think, though, that, Rick, I appreciate so much what you said, because unless the people have a vision, they will not act. It's the vision that drives the act. We've been saying that from the beginning. And I, if we act in what I'm asking for is that the context be enlarged within which we act. And that's constantly what I think you're saying, that people understand. And even, Rick, when, like we continue, if you pose the question back and forth again, do we understand or are we selfish? I think we're moving in and out of either cosmology or theology. The selfishness is, that question is a theological one. The deeper one I think we're probing with is our basic cosmology. Where do we fit as a species in this whole process? And that's the one that keeps, you know, and we keep running to our theology to try to answer that when we're not willing to grapple with the cosmological question. You know? And so the danger of a quick fix is surely there, but what else is there except that we act as we are enlightened to act in a new context? You know, so I'm not willing to put the burden of the movement on leadership. I think it's only the role, if leadership can create the vision for us, can help people to see something different, so that then in fact they work, and we don't know, and I don't think we will know until we have, until we're exploring the vision, and it opens the way for us. As we sit here kind of encrusted in our industrial economics and our thinking that has come out of a world we know we have outgrown, I don't think we can project the answers. It's only if we kind of see something, our vision breaks through, we take that next step, and then the next step is revealed. It's the process.
I agree with the process that you're talking about, but I hear Susan saying we may not be able to do that. We may have to take some actions. Let me finish. Some people may need to take some actions that maybe my grandchildren will understand, that even my own children that are under 10 may not understand. I mean, I'm thinking about the implications of what you're saying and the time frame. That may be a worst case scenario, but...
I like the writer who talked about it as insurance, like insurance. I think we've got to get ourselves some insurance. That's why I like to know, you know, what can we risk in the way of carbon emissions over the next 10, 20, 30 years? What can we risk? And let's make it insurance. Let us assume that we don't know what's going to happen. And nobody knows exactly what's going to happen. But let's get some insurance. I'm at the point where I want to know what the character of that insurance is from the point of view of somebody who's studying these interconnections. What's the character of the insurance? We need some insurance today before we know the full implications and know the full results and have the cause and effect. We know enough about cause and effect to know something, the direction of insurance.
Are you saying you want to know how much cushion we have? That one I'm not sure I can tell you. At this point,
well, Jerry's going to tell us Wednesday night.
Well, you know, what I'm going to, I'll talk about a couple of small dimensions of it, but you ask a person who lives in the Sudan, on the edge of the Sahara Desert, what margin they got, I mean, that's a very different kind of margin that we're talking about there. And there is a degree of urgency there that has to be recognized. And, you know, in the sense that Susan's talking about, a sense of needing to rush to the clock is running. Part of this, I think, is a denial. It's a denial in the sense that we want to believe that if we just act somehow together, right, that we can avoid anybody having to be in pain, discomfort, experiencing injustice. I think that's a denial. I really think that things are beyond our control in many ways. Things are going to play their way out in ways that we wouldn't want. I mean, already, what is the number? 65 million people who
die every day.
Yeah, you know, that is already out of control. And we need a little bit of humility, I think, in the sense of saying, well, we're just going to fix it up because it's too big. Some things are going to happen that are just beyond our control.
I'd like to hear what some of you think in terms of the distinctions between envisioning, the power of envision to evoke action, and fear tactics, scare tactics that also can evoke action, sometimes appropriate action, sometimes inappropriate action. And I'm reminded of a situation that's somewhat analogous, but I think there's some very profound differences. I'm thinking back to the late 1970s and early 1980s with the movement, the nuclear freeze movement, Colin Caldicott's founding of Physicians Against Social Responsibility. And I remember very clearly her warning, if you elect Ronald Reagan is elected in 1980, no one will live to 1988. I mean, it was put that coldly. And there's only a certain amount of capital there. There's only a certain number of times that you can say that before it, before you've spent your fear capital. And, you know, here it's 1989, Reagan's back in California, and the world has changed in part on the issue of nuclearism. Maybe not in its kernel, but certainly I don't worry so much about that. And so I'd like to hear what part fear plays in this situation, and what part hope plays or envisioning.
Helen Caldicott's not the only one. There's the population bomb.
Mm-hmm.
There's Spam 1975.
Mm-hmm.
In reaction to that, there is a book that was published by Reagan supporters called Why Are They Lying to Our Children? Which collected together large numbers of examples of people who have exaggerated or maintained that their crystal ball shows such and such happened and something else would happen. We had an example here at Holden just in the last week that I have to say it sends a shiver up and down my spine. We had a fire alarm set off, and as best I can tell, it was for the purpose of gathering people for a snowball fight.
Mm-hmm.
That's dangerous. That's calling wolf at the wrong time.
Mm-hmm.
There was, during the course of the Golden 2000 study, there was two groups pushing on him. There were a lot of groups, but two in particular. One who wanted to put in stuff that was saying things like, well, if we don't do this by next year, all hope is lost. And there were others who were wanting to just kind of downplay any kind of a serious. What I tried to do, to the best of my ability, was to go down the middle and not exaggerate, and also not to underestimate the seriousness of this thing. And I like what Rick says, that the Earth is a tremendously resilient thing, and he says, it's going to go on, whether we're here or not. And I think it's going to go on with us here, us as a species. But I suspect that there is going to be sometime in the next 100 years, there is going to be a big drop in human population.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is probably not going to come about as a result of declining birth rates. I think it's going to come about as a rise in death rates.
Mm-hmm.
People are going to have shorter lives. And but that, to me, doesn't mean the end. It could, you know, depending on how we respond. There are still huge arsenals of nuclear weapons, even though we feel the tension between East and West is down. And that for sure would make a mess. But I, for me anyway, the tactic of scare is not a good one. I think it just, in a way, it's lying. In a way, it's taking upon oneself the sense that you've got wisdom that nobody else has, and therefore you can frighten people into doing things, and I think that's dangerous in a lot of ways. So I much prefer to try to work toward the vision.
Toward what?
Toward a vision that motivates people to try to go forward rather than just the scare stuff.
Yeah, I think to agree with that and follow up on your point, the vision is what's important, and that we need to get beyond scare tactics to evoke that in people. And this is why I thought it was so important what you were raising with the church, because I would see the church as one of the major institutions that should be out there changing people's spirits.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen a good example for 8 years of somebody who could alter people's minds and hearts through the use of rhetoric and the mass media. Now that's very dangerous, but if you turn the clock back a ways, we saw during the 60s and early 70s the power of the arts and the popular arts to change people's hearts in the you know, the human rights and in the Vietnam movements. And I think things are so bad now that we need all of these things. Maybe there is a role for benevolent use of rhetoric. I don't know. I hate to see it in the political rhetoric advertising realm that we would change people's minds and hearts. I far prefer to see it in the arts and the music that we produce as a people, that we do it. But the church must find a role in that. And that's what I think we need to be looking at here.
I wasn't advocating scare tactics.
No, I know. But, yeah. But then maybe there is a role. I mean, there is a time to cry wolf. There is a time to say fire. You know, and we can't just be afraid of saying it when it mustn't be said.
That's telling the truth, though.
Yeah.
And I think that Joe's point about scaring as a way of deceptive engineering of reality is a good point. Mm.
I do think that it brings up something, what you speak about is fear, because I think so often we are fear-based individuals, that rather than operate out of vision as we might want to do, when we look at some of our instinctive behaviors, they likely come out of fear rather than out of vision or out of hope. And perhaps that is a role of the church, because I feel in my own life that in exploring theology and exploring the embodiment of theology in my daily life, I'm able to take a look at not only the hope we proclaim in the gospel, but also the fear that comes out of me as a person. I can't think of a better embodiment in this season of the year in Advent, of that embodiment of a hopefulness that does not just sort of deny the fact that we are a fearful people, but knows that we are a fearful people. And in the face of an environmental knowing that there's no possible way that I could ever become expert, it's too big of a problem for me. But yet to know that out of some sense of hopefulness, some sense of wisdom will come. And to be able to take those little steps, to take those actions with some confidence, knowing that, yes, I'm a fearful person, knowing, yes, that there is some hope that is available to me, and knowing that that's not going to disable me from taking some action, and perhaps out of that action, a greater awareness and a greater understanding and hence yielding more action will come. Perhaps that is the role of the church, that it can help enable people to not deny their fear, but recognize that it's there, but to say that can be married with hope. And therein, you can perhaps learn and take some action. So I don't think there's any reason to use scare tactics, but at the same time, I don't think that we ought to deny our fear. I think it's very real.
I wonder if we all have our ideas of what the church ought to be about. I wonder if there may not be some value in thinking about the church's role at helping humans to understand the art of compromise. I think that when we absolutize the things that have to be done, or when we use fear or something to cause people to act in a certain direction, we don't enable them to make the trade-offs that obviously are necessary to live with this earth that we have, and the limits, our own limits as well as the earth's limits. If I recall correctly, Random House's definition of the word compromise, I think it has 11 of them, I think only one of them is negative. And that most of the others even have biblical illusions or allusions. And I think that the grace of God is a compromise. I think that essentially God is about compromise. The soul that sinneth it shall die except Jesus Christ comes and compromises and takes it away. I wonder if that isn't a practical thing that we ought to be about in the church, to say we can, because our fear is, ought not be, I'm afraid of cancer, I'm not afraid to die. That our shifting our fear away from obliteration to what is possible to work against, to remove cancer or to change the environment. And the trade-off increases. We are such absolutizing beings, you know? And we ought to be trade-off type people. That's what I think.
I don't hear that talked about very much in the church.
Can't get his hand up.
It's not near as in depth as Elmer. I just want to stop a potential rumor about the use of a Holden fire alarm. Especially since our fire chief is out of the village and is probably a bit nervous after hearing. A Holden fire alarm was set off by a dryer that was overheated in agave, and then upon resetting the fire alarm system, it didn't hold. And it is true that some of the people waiting outside the host houses didn't show up on the phone. That was not the purpose of the fire alarm.
Thank you. The guest here didn't hear the full account. We only heard about the snowball fight.
Thank you, Jim. I tell you, you're a little nervous.
You talk about vision. The only significant discussion of vision that I've heard since I've been here James talked about the connectedness with nature and the kind of an overall understanding of our being as being part of the earth, and not simply acting on the earth, but part of the earth, and in that sense having to look at our connections with the earth. And what you'll find on Friday is that I suggest that the whole, as does the document from the churches, the whole industrial complex is about something which we can't be about. Now, so I don't know quite how you envision. I'm reading an author now who suggests that the Benedictine monasteries are the best institutional vision for what needs to happen in response to the fall of the Roman Empire that we have today. I think there's some vision in this author, but...
We're Augustinian.
Big part.
We're Augustinian.
Anyway, well, I'm trying to say that I think there are two levels to operate on. One is what I call insurance, and I like that. I like it better and better the more I hear you talk. That we do need to make some judgments about what kind of insurance we need. And that will be broad action on the part of governments, individuals too, but mostly on the part of governments and international institutions, which sets some frameworks which respond to the critical nature that some people at least think is there, to cut down on carbon emissions and do all kinds of things to do it. That's insurance. But that does not deal with the drives and the sense of what's important to be in human life that create the use of energy, create the use of all of our minerals that lead to the job. There's a whole other level of thinking about the issue in terms of what we do with our existence and what the goals are. How it functions. This author thinks we just have to get rid of the international markets, which drive and control and run the whole world. So there are all kinds of levels. I have some information that would at least lead in the direction of the insurance. What broad policies are needed to prevent more movement in what's considered to be, by you, a disastrous direction. And Jerry says he doesn't know. I don't. Who does know? Who does have any idea of what these directions are? If we don't have the idea, how do we get them? How do we get the sense of this direction?
I'll offer you suggestion in that direction and part of taking the vision. And I haven't got your name straight in my head yet. No.
Excellent. Oh, John.
John.
Yes.
And it's a point on which I guess I'd like to argue a little bit, and that's the point where you say we can't be an expert. And this is one of the excuses that is repeated at least twice in the World Council of Churches document, that we can't be experts. And the vision that I would hold out for you as something that I think would help us to come to an understanding, and that I think could make a tremendous difference in the willingness of the church to offer a vision, a more complete vision, is if perhaps one quarter of the effort that goes into the intellectual effort that goes into training to be a pastor were devoted to understanding, developing some sphere of hearing the earth. Now, I think that in 1 year of the kind of training that, you know, with the level of intensity that goes into becoming an accountant or a physician or a lawyer or a pastor, one can become so much more expert than we are now that the tragedy is nobody's doing it. It is not perceived as being an integral part of becoming anything. One of the things I liked about physicians for social responsibility is somebody, Helen Caldicott, was in effect saying, part of your vocatio as a physician is to care for the health of the planet, and there is nothing that is a bigger threat to it than, you know, who's going to stand up and say that as a part of your vocation as a Christian, you need to know what's happening to the creation? You know, nobody's doing that. And I think there's a whole lot that could be done, and that we could become very quickly and very easily far more expert if somehow we'd say that. And out of that searching that would go on then, I think could emerge some vision. The present, you know, I can point to, as you are, a number of places where people have got parts of the vision. But I hesitate to do it, even in this group, because you'd think I was a loony. You really would. Because people are not far enough along
That's what I want to hear.
Come on, risk it.
So Pete's got to hand up.
Just one other piece of that, though, Al. If you say, you know, we don't know, well, you know, and you certainly see that one piece of the evidence that it is that as a species, our impact to date has not been a healthy one for the total picture. Okay, that's one thing. Where are people living in or have lived traditionally in a way that is a healthy? And the only thing we can point to that we know of is what native peoples, how native peoples have lived and continue to live with the earth in a harmonious relationship thousands of years. So
small
one of the...
Small populations.
Fine, but why? Within a context, you know? I mean, that we turn to some of the people who carry a wisdom, a genetic wisdom, that has not been super encoded by a cultural... by a cultural coding that has removed them from their relationship with the earth. And there are many voices saying that if there's something in the wisdom of the native peoples that we have to learn, that they carry something deeply embedded within them. So I you know, we don't, it seems very easy for us to kind of turn to our the development of our professions, and rightly so. There's wisdom to be gained there. But I think that we dismiss the wisdom that is closer to what we will probably have to come arrive at.
You're positing that in a sense, in some differentiation from what we would see as expert or not?
From the native people?
Are you saying the wisdom as somehow separate from or different than what is expert?
Well, no, I guess I shouldn't make that, you know, so one is more formally developed. But I do it more from the evidence that's there in the lived reality.
One of the realities that we live with, I think, is what expert means for us. I work with a different community at MIT, and expert there means knowing one little bit of the whole picture very, very, very well. People can't talk to each other. I mean, they can hardly talk to each other about the same problem because they all have intensive knowledge about one aspect, which is not so related to everything else. But they're really expert at that. Mm-hmm. They really know that. Mm-hmm.
When I was a graduate student in physics, we used to say that to get a PhD is to learn more and more about less and less until you know nothing at all.
I remember Kierkegaard's definition of what a room full of experts is. A crowd.
Well, but it's heartening to me to hear you say that in a year, you know, we really could have some expertise. We would know some, you know. That's really true, like, you know. And maybe in a broader sense.
How it's been doing.
Yeah. 9 months.
But Jerry, would it be fair to say then that every morning, along with Bible study, we have to have Earth study? Is that fair?
That's a bit of wisdom that comes from Jane, and she hasn't enunciated yet. And I agree with it.
I do too.
And how do we go about that study?
Well, that's okay. If you're willing to if you're willing to ask the question, I think we mm-hmm. could find ways. Mm-hmm. But I, like Rick, even demonstrating some of the interconnect. We know the interconnect. We say that word, but to really see that operating in real ways, the delicate interconnect. I mean, you come away from that, you know, knowing what that word means, not up here but here. Mm-hmm. And there, so the expertise, I don't want to dismiss it either, nor do, you know, that there way, but what are we studying? What are we putting our expertise to draw forth? So I just very broadly say earth learning and earth study.
Well, I guess what my question meant is, by earth study, are you talking about something of the spiritual nature, like Native Americans, or are you talking about sitting down with a textbook?
Well, I'm sitting down with the microbes and watching mm-hmm. how does that work? You know, how do they operate with it? And discovering that the bees know how to get to that bowl of honey after 6 days. And I don't know if you were here, I told that little story. But, you know, all kinds of things that we, I think, as a species are completely ignorant of, that the rest of the created world lives off of, and it's us. You know, it's who we are in one facet of our evolution.
Part of what that accomplishes, I think, is personalizing the interconnectedness so that we know how any action we take might have ramifications for other economies and other parts of the environment, and we also know what the implications of the environmental changes are for us as ourselves. So all of a sudden, mm-hmm.
I think that's really important, because you know, when you were saying earlier when you were doing your presentation that this is too obvious to say, mm-hmm. it may be too obvious to say, but none of us have felt it yet. So somehow,
we don't believe it.
Yeah, it's too connected. Obvious to say, but somehow, it's certainly not too obvious to, I don't know what the right word is.
I think you've just said it, to feel it.
Yeah.
I mean, we can know it, but we also have to feel it, and we won't feel it unless, as Jane says, we also experience it. And I think all of those components need to be put together. And I hear that. That's what you're calling for, right? Yeah.
Or, you know, like a naturalist next to the biblical scholar. Mm-hmm. And we walk a path every morning and just find and then mm-hmm. read. And there, and that's that sense of awe and wonder that it evokes, you know, that this is just so much bigger than any of us can. And we say that about God, and I want to be able to say the same thing about the earth. But the earth itself has this inner, numinous, you know, life that just ought to therefore put us in a posture of reverence and you know.
I just want to say it's not hard. I'll be really quick. I know. But this fall, my wife and I led it, and this isn't tooting, but it's just an experience. She's in environmental education, and so we had a women's retreat this fall. And she did the scientific part, and I did the biblical theological part. And we had walks. We had a night walk and talked about that, and a marsh walk, and talked about symbiosis and interrelatedness and connectedness biblically and theologically, and even had a rappelling time off of a rock cliff if you wanted to do it. And put all of those things together and interconnect. And it's not hard to do. It's just not hard. And any parish can do that sort of thing just by using the gifts that are already there. And there are plenty of scientists and people with those skills in a parish. And all a pastor has to do is ask them to do a retreat with her or him. It's just, you know.
Well, except that we ought to be ready for what we would consider the grossness of the creation. The destructiveness of the creation. I understand the Aboriginals, my little brief visit to Australia, had their own ways, surely, of birth control and of shortening the lives of the people in the group, the tribe of 17. And you stayed behind and died when a baby was born. And you only kept one of the twins. And we think that's gross. We ought to be ready for that part of it, too. It isn't only beauty in the sense that we understand it, but the hardness of the creation as well. At least what we call it. I'm willing to change all those words as we get to know about it, but we call it certain things. Just as we call it. We still call a lot of things evil. It may not be evil at all, but we have to be ready for that. And I think that's where the community of faith is so important to sustain us as we open up to these harder lessons to learn, whether it's of overwhelming beauty or overwhelming difficulty.
The other thing that I think overwhelms me with these notions of interconnectedness gets back to the way that human activities are interconnected within the world economy, and I'll describe some visions of a dismantling of the industrial society. Whenever I start to, as much as I can affirm that, whenever I start to think about how it could happen, and can we extract ourselves and our creation from what we have woven here? When we start to begin to talk about how the environmental controls would be implemented and what the social and economic implications of those are, and the pain that may result from the trade-offs and the compromises, that's when I feel myself most easily overwhelmed by the prospects.
Well, Jared told me that we should cut down our carbon emissions by 90%. That would be the safe level to think about cutting them down. Now, if you begin to think of the implications of that for the economy.
Think about what happened in the 70s with the energy price rises and how that rippled through the entire world economy, and even today we are paying for that.
Boy, though, Elmer just brought up another subject. I mean, you know, we talk about fossil fuels so much, I just want to lift it to say there are a lot of other suggested things. I think about the tremendous amount of monetary resources we put into medical care, and especially prolonging life in our society, both sort of passively and actively. I mean, that's, and the astronomical costs for medical care these days. I'm thinking about the Aborigine, this thing back, you know. We're doing just the opposite, you know.
I'm alive because somebody spent $53,000 for a bypass.
You know, the woman physician in our congregation to whom I go gave a talk about medical ethics. And one of the questions that came up to her, when she was talking about the triage, basically, about putting people in intensive care. I mean, there are many more people than you can put in there. I asked her, how much does it cost today to be in intensive care? She had no idea. Mm-hmm. Zero. The system, the separation of accountability from the decisions has gotten to the point where a physician, a Christian physician in my own congregation, can make decisions about whether or not you go into intensive care, and never, ever, in the entire course of her life as a physician, ever think about what it costs. You know, it blows my mind away to think about that.
My granddaughter's going to be 2 this month, and they've spent $300,000 so far. Mm-hmm. To overcome the tumor. Mm-hmm. Is that there?
Nobody wants to answer that question.
Yeah, when we look at some of the, we're a Christian group here, and when we look at some of the Christian statistics, I think we can also be rather sad and realize our lack of confidence. Two or three years ago, the Zondervan representative came and was telling about the NIV, New International Bible, and she mentioned in the course of her talk that she says 90% of the Christians nowadays never frequent the Christian bookstore. I thought, my word. And that means that the vast majority, 90% of our people in churches nowadays don't want to grow spiritually. And I think that a lot of very confident ministers and people have said, well, a lot of our people are spiritually bankrupt. Are spiritually ignorant. And I think there's a lot of that out there. So when we look at, as long as Christendom's been going and as many high-quality teachers, as much education as we pour into our ministers, and as much organization as we have, and as much as we assert that you can have a better life in this world and a better life in the world to come if you are Christians, high-quality Christians and stuff, and yet we can't seem to accomplish that goal with our people, how in the world are we going to accomplish on a very short time frame a radical ecological change about all the lead time and everything and all the expertise that we've had in the world of Christendom for so many, many years?
There's another possibility for explaining some of what you were saying, 90% don't go to a Christian bookstore. And that is that probably 90% of the people who go to sit in the pews don't read. They watch television. They read the ads now. Maybe a little bit, but they don't do any serious reading.
Yeah, well, that's wrong. The church has let them get to the point where they watch TV so much.
You have more talents than the power of the church.
I just quit.
Yeah, well, it was 10, 15 years ago when I heard the statistics on TV, the kids, by the time they graduate from high school, had seen a quarter of a million murders, and that they spent more time in front of the idiot box than they had in their studies 10, 15 years ago. I said, well, my word, how in the world can we turn out a decent population of morally responsible adults if that kind of statistics? And we can't.
Just the poem gets television, I won't come.
What do you think?
Rick, thank you.
Thank you all for your discussion.
Thank you.